Ms. Adelson.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. I represent Betty Lauren Maltese on her sentencing appeal. There are two issues raised by Ms. Lauren Maltese on her sentencing appeal, and unless the Court has any questions on the first issue, which deals with the loss calculation, I'd like to turn to the second issue, which is the reasonableness of this non-conforming, non-guideline sentence. Had the court imposed a sentence of 97 months in this case, had it imposed a guideline sentence, the sentence would be less by anywhere from 2 to 4 years, depending on where in the range she was sentenced, and I think that's actually assuming a high end of the range, and the variance is anywhere from 37% to 91%. A variance of such nature must be justified, as must any variance now, by the Section 355(3A) factors, keeping in mind, of course, the principle of parsimony, and also, as this Court has said several times, the greater the variance, the more compelling the justification for the variance
must
be. What's
the principle of parsimony? I missed that.
The principle of parsimony is actually how Section 355(3A) begins, which is that a sentence should be no greater than necessary to meet the purposes set forth in Section 355(3A). It has not necessarily been something
That's quite empty, really.
That's ambiguous.
To say you shouldn't have a gratuitously, excessive sentence, right?
Exactly, and I think that's exactly what it should
not
be.
I don't see that. Very serious crime. I don't understand the
Well, I'd like
problem
to turn then to the very first 355(3A) factor, which is the nature and characteristics of the crime and the personal history and characteristics of the defendant. And I think that also encompasses some of the other 355(3A) factors, such as whether the defendant is likely to commit a crime in the future or promoting just punishment, the factors that are set forth in 355(3A)(2). Betty Lauren Maltese...
That's for the district judge to consider.
Well, if that were only for the district court to consider, then I don't think
Unless
the Supreme
something
Court...
something that's, really wild. But obviously, it's a quintessentially discretionary judgment.
Right at this moment, the Supreme Court is going to be considering in the two cases, which I'm sure the Court is aware, Rita and Claiborne, what is meant by the standard of reasonableness review, which the Supreme Court did not say in Booker meant that district courts had unlimited discretion.
Of course
not. The discretion is cabined.
Abuse of discretion means do something really unreasonable. Unreasonable doesn't just mean we disagree, we think it's a little too harsh, means something unreasonable. I don't see what the judge did.
I think it means unreasonable with reference to the Section 355(3A) factors. The sentencing judge may consider the sentence...
This is a very serious crime. Corrupt a whole city?
The crime
really,
is
not,
serious.
It's not run of the mind,
If she had been, if Betty had received a guideline sentence in this case, her sentence would be in excess of 5 years. Recent Sentencing Commission statistics...
That would be a very inadequate sentence, in my opinion, for a crime of this magnitude.
Recent Sentencing Commission statistics establish that for first-time offense... These are from the Sentencing Commission.
This is a very unusual offense. This is not a standard first-time offense by some kid or something. It's corrupting an entire city over a long period of years, and that's very serious crime.
Your Honor, I think the seriousness of the crime is taken into account in the guideline sentence, which accounts for the amount of the fraud, the planning, and turning to the personal characteristics of the defendant, they are a factor that must be considered. And even the district court, who was no fan of Betty Lauren Maltese, acknowledged that until she became town president, she led an exemplary life, that she did much that was good for the town.
That's the kind of thing you argue to a district judge. We're not in the business of balancing her exemplary pre-criminal life against very serious crimes.
I must disagree, Judge Posner, because if that were the case, then I think there would be no appellate review after.
No. When you have review for reasonableness, review for abuse of discretion, that's to deal with situations in which the judge has done something which really cannot be, given a rational explanation. And that can be on the leniency side or on the severity side.
Although
but
I think
I don't see that in this case.
I think that that is exactly the question that will be looked at.
This is not a very heavy sentence by modern American standards.
Well, it is well in excess of the median and mean sentences for racketeering offenses.
This is very unusual criminality, right? This is not garden variety racketeering. This is taking over a city and, you know, milking it for years for this gang of which she was a principal figure.
However, she did not line her own pockets with any of the proceeds of the fraud. The government investigated her for years, and the most that she received were these modest insurance benefits that were shared by other members of the TAN officials and was in existence before SRC came into the picture. She didn't even come into the picture here, Betty Lauren Maltese, till the fraud was in place for at least a year, and the first year and a half at least, she was caring for her.
Many criminals don't benefit in any pecuniary sense from their crimes, right?
No, I'm not sure that many criminals don't benefit from their crimes.
Murderers,
but certainly,
murderers, do
they may have a psychological benefit. I think that's a factor, though, that goes
into
the
Why do you think she committed these crimes?
Well, that remains.
If she didn't get a benefit from them.
I think she was inexperienced. She was completely inexperienced when she became town president, and I think that that remains unknown from the record in this case. I see that I would like the court to at least await the decisions in Rita and Claiborne. I see where the court is going, but I think that having read the briefs in that those cases as well as the amicus briefs, I think the court is going to have a lot on its plate in analyzing what kind of circumstances would justify a variance from the guidelines. Argument is scheduled for February 20th, and I would ask the court to at least consider holding off resolution of this case until the Supreme Court explicates further what it means by reasonableness review.
Well, what difference does it make to you? I mean, obviously, we'd have to conform our decision to whatever the Supreme Court does.
Well, it may shed light on whether a sentence that is at variance with the guidelines.
Well, why would you care whether we decide this case before or after the Supreme Court?
Because if it's decided, if the Supreme Court's case is helpful for us, I'd like an opportunity to call it to the court's
attention.
We may be well beyond the in the process beyond that at that point.
Hardly.
So it becomes harder and harder as the case proceeds.
You would ask for cert for our sentence, and. And if
you don't know,
right? If the Supreme Court,
but that the chances are decrease as you get further along in the process.
No.
As the court
if
is
there
aware.
Were tension between what we did and what the Supreme Court did, then it would vacate our decision and remand for reconsideration in light of their decisions, right? That's
if it's there are certain kinds of tension that may be true for, and then there are other kinds of tension.
Bench about how we should best conduct our business is
no, I'm not. I've just said I'd ask the court to consider. I would certainly by no means tell the court what to do.
Before you sit down, though, let me tell you what I find very aggravating here. When I looked at this case 3 weeks ago or so, and again a couple of days ago, the most interesting issue to me was Mr. Dershowitz claim that the government improperly substituted assets and was going to take back $600,000 in attorney's fees. I get down to Chicago yesterday, and I see that issue is taken off the table.
No, the issue is not completely taken off the table. The lawsuit, the law firm has resolved its, has withdrawn its appeal, the law firms, my law firm and Mr. Dershowitz's law firm, because we have resolved our case with the government. Betty Lauren Maltese's contesting of the fourth order of forfeiture is still, we believe, a viable claim, still raises the issues that we raised in our brief, and still implicates her Sixth Amendment rights.
My question is, when we're told that an issue, and this was a, again, maybe I'm wrong, but I thought this was the sexiest issue in this case.
It certainly was.
Yeah, it's a lot of money, a huge amount of money in attorney's fees, and the government is seeking forfeiture of the attorney's fees from the attorney. And we're told that this is resolved, you know, after I'm sure all of us put in time to get up to speed on that important issue. And then we're told, right on the eve of argument,
It had been settled in November. What is the reason why you left us in the dark for 6 weeks?
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I missed the question.
This issue was settled in November. The district court issued its decision on the 26th of November, and you chose not to alert us for 6 weeks.
As to the withdrawal of the appeal of the law firms, I think we had to address issues as to whether it kept the appeal alive as to Betty Lauren Maltese. We had to speak with our client about that.
Why did you not alert us for 6 weeks after the district court entered judgment on the settlement?
As to the law firms. I apologize, Your Honor. We should have done so earlier.
When do you think judges prepare for oral argument? 7 weeks before oral argument?
I apologize, Your Honor. We should have alerted early. We were not sure the impact would have.
Trying to talk down a judge while a judge is talking is also of no good to you or your client. But wasting a judge's time won't help you either. I mean, this was extraordinarily inconsiderate of the time of this bench. And I don't understand why a lawyer who bills by the hour for her own time would think that our time is worthless. But that was the impression you conveyed.
I apologize.
Well, what survives of the forfeiture issue, if anything?
The government's fourth order of forfeiture was against Betty Lauren Maltese, not against the law firms. And a certain portion, and it was against funds that were neither racketeering.
Yeah, but how is she affected?
There was a certain portion of money that was handed over to the lawyers for future legal work because appeals are never quite clear what their parameters will be. For instance, there could be a cert petition here.
The argument in the Lauren Maltese brief is that those funds can't be reached. Your argument now sounds like you want them reached so that $400,000 would be removed from her forfeiture obligation. But that wasn't even remotely the argument made in Lauren Maltese's brief.
No, I think the argument in Lauren Maltese's brief is that those funds can't be reached, and we maintain that those funds can't be reached. They are substitute assets that were distributed to third parties before any order of forfeiture, and they're not subject to forfeiture under Section 1963A or under 1963M, and that the fourth order of forfeiture should be vacated as to her.
Your client $250,000 better off than she would be if that position were accepted. So what's left for appeal?
Well, she has an obligation to the attorneys.
She owes the millions anyway.
It's a joint and several liability as well, so if the forfeiture is paid by other defendants, it might not impact on her. And she does have an outstanding obligation then to her attorneys who have resolved the case with the government. And again, I apologize, Your Honor, for not alerting sooner. We were talking to our client about the issue as it pertained to her and whether we would be withdrawing her appeal as well, but I do apologize.
Mm-hmm. But just to run through that again, she does have a stake in this forfeiture issue.
We believe very much so, because $625,000 of non-forfeitable assets are subject to forfeiture. Part of those assets included monies that she used to pay her attorney, which were untainted assets, which are not covered then by Kaplan or Monsanto, for future legal work that she will now not be able to use for future legal work should there be any future legal work on this case. It impacts her Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
Totally lost. This is the very issue that was settled. Did your client file a notice of appeal from the judgment entered on November 26th?
The issue that was settled was the...
That can be answered yes or no.
No.
Did your client file a notice of appeal from that order?
No.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. LaPuma?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I see the time has expired. I was prepared to present an oral argument. Our argument is adequately stated.
You have your 3 minutes.
Well, thank you, Judge. Judge, in United States versus Cunningham, this Court held that where a district court fails to mention a recognized basis for a legal basis that has been presented by a defendant, that could be considered an error. In this case, Judge Grady did mention the argument we presented, which we feel had an adequate legal basis, but Judge Grady refused to consider it. And so contrary to the holding...
No, he considered it. He refused to accept your argument that a policeman should get a lighter sentence because the other prisoners don't like him.
But, Judge, I think if you look at the language that Judge Grady used...
It seems an entirely appropriate discretionary judgment for a judge to make.
But, Judge, it's contrary to what the Supreme Court said and Justice Kennedy wrote in the Kuhn decision, where it says a sentencing court may consider conditions of confinement.
Sure, it may consider. He could consider that, Judge Grady. He did consider it. He just didn't think it warranted a discount in the sentence.
Well, Judge,
it's eminently reasonable.
Judge, obviously you're taking the position the government's taken, and I'm slightly, with all due deference and respect to the court, slightly taken aback.
I don't understand what position I'm taking. I am not saying that it isn't something appropriate for a judge to consider. It is appropriate for him to consider it, but he is not required to grant a sentencing discount on that basis, that we're not going to lay down that rule of law which says policemen get lighter sentences than other people who commit the same crime, which is what you want.
That's not necessarily so, Judge. Judge Grady did present
that
to me.
That's what you want. That's what you want, a rule which says police get lighter sentences than other criminals.
With all due respect, Judge, I'm arguing on an individual basis for Emil Shulo, the chief of police who has received a lot of notoriety because of this case, a person who has, by the Bureau of Prison standards, suffered more stringent conditions of confinement, including being brought back to the MCC here for his resentencing after this court's opinion and being held in the hole for 23 hours a day because for his own protection, according to the Bureau of Prisons. Those are recognized basis for a lower sentence, a variant from the guideline range. I'm talking on an individual basis, Judge.
Look,
and I would
you're just repeating yourself. Yes, it is a basis, and you want us to say it is a mandatory basis, that a judge is not permitted to say, I hear you, but I'm not going to do it.
Judge, I don't think that's what Judge Grady said. I think Judge Grady said, and if you look at those words closely, I think it's across the board, no police officer in any circumstance ever should get this kind of sentencing discount. I don't think he considered individually. And, of course, that is incorrect. It's incorrect under 3553A because of the history and characteristics of this individual defendant. It's incorrect under Kuhn. It's incorrect under the Tenth Circuit's decision in LaValle and even this court's decision in Wilkie several years ago. My position, Judge, is the Judge Grady said he would not consider this in any for any reason for any defendant, that it's not something that the sentencing court should consider. And I think that's where the error is. So I think it's just an interpretation of the way we're perceiving Judge.
What did he say that leads you to that interpretation?
He said in his...
What did he say exactly?
He says, this is something that should not be considered, in my view. Those are his words. It is highlighted, it is quoted and highlighted in our brief, Judge. And in our reply brief, he had prefatory comments, which he indicated that he was not inclined to do it. He asked me my opinion, and I said yes and no. Under some circumstances, it's appropriate to do it. Not across the board in every circumstance, not across the board for denying it as well. But he indicated clearly in his language that it's not something that should be considered. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. LaPuma. Mr. Bindi.
Good morning. May it please the court. Regarding the sentence imposed on Ms. Loren Maltese, Your Honors, we feel that the four-level upward adjustment for extraordinary abuse of trust is an issue that was decided in the first appeal in this case. There was no reason pertaining to the sentencing remand that would have rendered that issue moot, and the court never said in its opinion that any of the issues were not decided. It said that there were many issues that were too insubstantial to merit discussion. So it's our view that that issue has already been decided and need not be redecided in this case. In any event, the sentence was reasonable. This was a fraud that occurred over 5 years' time, involved a $10 million loss, involved enormous disruption of the employee health benefit plan and the ability of town employees to receive health care. Cicero was forced to borrow heavily to maintain its budget, and the degree of authority that Lauren Maltese had over the town was what made this fraud possible. So that was a reasonable sentence. We also think that it's our position that Lauren Maltese's appeal of the fourth order of forfeiture is moot. There is no relief that this court can grant her. Regarding Shulo's sentence, for a district court to reject, even categorically, a permissible but unmentioned sentencing factor is not a violation of 3553A. It certainly is not something that constitutes a rejection of
concern. But there is something odd about the way Judge Grady put it. The way he puts it, he says those things are going to happen. That's the more severe conditions of confinement. But they're also perfectly foreseeable to a policeman. And what he's saying, in effect, is that police are to be punished more heavily because they're police, right? Which is not what the guidelines or the statute says.
I don't think
he says that there are two components of punishment. One is the length of the sentence, the other the conditions under which it's served. And he's saying that for all police, because the conditions are more severe, their sentence for identical crimes that non-police commit will in fact be heavier. They'll be the same length, but they'll be more severe conditions. It's as if he said, because we particularly abhor crimes by policemen, we're going to put all policemen will serve their sentences in solitary confinement. Now, that clearly would be improper.
That would be, yeah. Well, Your Honor.
So isn't this quite similar?
No. There is the component regarding conditions of confinement, and they're going to be different for police officers. They're going to be different for lots of people sentenced to prison. There are lots of categories of prisoners that suffer conditions of confinement that are different from the general run of the prison population.
Child molesters do, don't they?
Child molesters, people who commit notorious or infamous crimes, well-publicized cases. There's a lot of categories of defendants that are going to have certain conditions of confinement that are going to differ from the general run of the prison population. The question is whether that is a sufficient reason to grant a reduction in the length of the sentence.
No, it doesn't compel it. The question is whether the judge, instead of considering this as an individual matter, is imposing a rule that police are properly punished more severely than other people.
That's not exactly the way Judge Grady...
Not exactly, but it's pretty close, isn't it?
It's not far off the mark. Judge Grady did make the point that police officers are much more vulnerable to temptations to commit crimes than most people, and that therefore in need of greater specific deterrence. And I think that...
That's the sort of thing you'd expect to find in the guidelines, wouldn't you? See, he says there should be no favorable treatment of a dishonest policeman, and what bothers me a little about that is that it's not favorable treatment if you adjust the length to compensate for a difference in the conditions.
Well, I would disagree with that, Your Honor. There are things that can be done to compensate for certain types of conditions of confinement short of adjusting the length of the sentence. Sentencing within the range, for instance, the low end of the range rather than mid or high end. But granting a sentence reduction below the range certainly was something that was committed to Judge Grady's discretion, and it was his view that sort of compensation for the things that police officers would suffer in confinement, something that's perfectly predictable to the police officer when he decides to commit the crime, is not the length that he wanted to go to.
Now, on Lauren Maltese, your view is that the only thing that was left open for her to consider, for the judge to consider on remand was the was that $10.6 million figure. We disapproved of him. We disapproved of his rounding down.
Correct.
Is that so your point is that's the only correction that he was required to make?
That was the only correction
that this court
ordered the district court to make.
But he discusses more things in his resentencing.
Yes, the defendant.
I mean, suppose we remanded on just one point, and then he thought up some new points, which then influenced his sentence. Well, that would be reviewable, right?
Yes, it would.
Yeah. So is it clear that he just looked at that one point and didn't add anything to his consideration in the resentencing?
He considered a lot of things on the resentencing, including arguments on the four-level adjustment for extraordinary abuse of trust. It was our position down there and here that this court had already decided that, but Judge Grady did reconsider it and reimposed it.
Now, one of the things that is troublesome to me about that is his continued use of the term upward departure. So what bothers me is, so we have a presumption in favor of on appellate review, presumption that the guidelines, that a sentence within the guidelines range is okay. But I don't think a sentence is within the guidelines range if it has been created by taking upward departures, right? You calculate a guidelines range with various adjustments. That's the guidelines range. Upward departures or downward departures going outside the range, and there's no longer the presumption. So it doesn't seem that the judges ought to be talking anymore about departures. It makes it seem as if they want to get the presumption by by getting their non-guideline sentence into the guidelines range by doing departures.
I agree, Your Honor, that this is definitely a sentence outside the guideline range. I guess I'm not as troubled as the court is, perhaps by the way the district court articulated what it did here. Because the reality is that what the court did was an upward variance of four levels.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's really consistent with the spirit of Booker. That is, as I interpret Booker, the judge sets a guidelines range, and then he goes to 353A and considers other factors. That approach gets blurred when the judge determines the guidelines range, then starts doing upward departures and getting to another range, and then staying in that range without having... So that's just a distraction, really, from what the judge should be doing.
I'm working on a case right now, Your Honor, in which the district court did just that. It was a lot closer to Booker in time than this resentencing.
That makes a difference. And
I don't think that the judge was trying to, in some sneaky way, take advantage of the presumption of reasonableness.
That. No, it's just what they were accustomed to from the back.
Exactly. And you know, in the case that I'm working on, the district court adjusted downward and started talking about the new range.
Right.
And you know, that was just this not appropriate mindset, and we certainly wouldn't have any opposition to the court pointing that out here. But, you know, again, there's no question that Judge Grady sentenced Lauren Maltese outside the guideline range by 4 points upward.
Now, it has always been a peculiarity in this case why, given Lauren Maltese's key role, you know, in the plot, why she never seemed to benefit much. I mean, she did get these medical benefits and so on, but she didn't seem to get her, quote, fair share of the take. Has that ever been explored?
Your Honor,
I mean, Ms. Adelson talked about, you know, about other criminals having psychological rewards from their crimes. I just wondered whether in this protracted proceeding, that issue has been addressed.
Well, Your Honor, the evidence at trial is what it is, and there was scant evidence of tangible benefits other than the health care side of it. The government used all of its tools to explore that issue, and we presented to the jury what we presented, and that, I'm afraid that's as far as I can go.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bindi. The case is taken under advisement.